I never imagined I would be speaking to a man who confessed to more murders than any serial killer in U.S. history. But when Jillian Lauren started decoding cold case files alongside Texas Ranger James Holland, the name Samuel Little kept surfacing. Little, a drifter and former boxer turned murderer, admitted to strangling at least 93 women between 1970 and 2005. His words shockingly confirmed in over 60 cases. What made Little's confessions extraordinary was his remarkable gift. He drew haunting portraits of his victims from memory, releasing them to the FBI and reigniting investigations on unsolved cases. These drawings sparked name-by-name identifications and led to emotional reunions between families and long-lost justice. As we relive my journey tracing his chilling path, from Georgia roots to West Coast alleyways, this story transforms statistics into names and faceless ghosts into real women with histories and dreams. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Drifter in the Shadows. When the arrest report hit my desk in 2012, the name didn't jump out. Samuel Little, another aging black man with a string of petty crimes and a long trail of forgotten warrants. To most in the justice system, he was a ghost drifting through America's underbelly. No permanent address, no bank accounts, and no obvious ties to any community. But something about this arrest in a Kentucky homeless shelter caught the attention of Texas Ranger James Holland, and eventually, mine. Samuel Little had been picked up on a narcotics charge. Just another addict in the system, they thought. But when his fingerprints were run through the FBI's database, they pinged something bigger. Three cold cases from the late 1980s, all women strangled to death in Los Angeles. That's when the system finally woke up. That's when the man who had once escaped justice over and over again began to speak. At the time, Little was 72 years old. He had liver disease, he was tired, and he was ready to talk. When I first heard about the interviews, I assumed it was another jailhouse confession, partly real, mostly performance. But Ranger Holland believed otherwise. He wasn't just listening to a man confess. He was watching a man reconstruct decades of murder from pure memory. No files, no prompts, no photographs, just details. Minuscule, intimate, and horrifying. Little didn't just recall the women he killed. He described them. Skin tones, hairstyles, what they wore, where he left their bodies, what cities he met them in, and sometimes, even what they said before they died. Then came the drawings. Samuel Little began sketching their faces, portraits in colored pencil, one after another. As an investigative journalist specializing in unsolved murders and forensic reconstruction, I had seen my share of courtroom exhibits, but these sketches were different. These were the faces of women who had disappeared from every trace of public memory. Their families never got answers. Police reports had gone cold, and now, decades later, their killer was giving them back their identities, one haunting portrait at a time. But it was never about closure. Not for him. Not even for justice. Samuel Little seemed to enjoy it. In 2013, he was convicted of three murders: Guadalupe Apodaca, Audrey Nelson, and Carol Alford, all strangled in Los Angeles between 1987 and 1989. The evidence was strong. DNA, cold case files, and witness testimony. But no one expected what would happen next, after his life sentence. Little kept talking. From his prison cell, he began to confess to more murders. At first, it sounded like he was making things up, trying to gain attention or manipulate the system. But the details matched open cases. In some instances, he provided information that had never been released publicly, like the location of a motel, the name of a gas station, a nickname the victim used. And over time, law enforcement confirmed what we all feared. Samuel Little wasn't exaggerating. He had killed at least 93 women across 19 states. He targeted women who were on the margins, sex workers, drug users, runaways, and women of color. People society didn't look for. Victims who slipped through the cracks. That was his method, and it worked. I began my own investigation in late 2018 when the FBI released a public statement calling Little the most prolific serial killer in U.S. history. They published 16 of his sketches online, hoping families would recognize the faces. Within weeks, tips started flooding in. Families saw their sisters, their mothers, their missing cousins, people they hadn't heard from in 20, even 30 years. One of the most haunting stories came from Macon, Georgia. A woman named Deborah McCall had gone missing in 1977. Her family never stopped looking, but the case went cold, like so many others. Then, in 2019, her sister saw a sketch. Vivid green eyes, a high bun, and a sad half-smile. "That's her," she whispered. "That's my sister." It wasn't just one case. It was dozens. Women from Florida, Ohio, Arkansas, Texas, Nevada, Mississippi, all remembered now because the man who ended their lives couldn't forget their faces. And yet, despite the attention, the press, and the breakthroughs, a dark question lingered. Why did it take so long? Samuel Little had been arrested more than 100 times. He had been charged with 8 murders before his 2012 arrest. Charges that were later dropped due to lack of evidence, unreliable witnesses, or poor prosecution. How does someone murder nearly 100 people and avoid justice for 4 decades? The answer, chillingly, lies in the invisibility of his victims. Little knew the system. He knew which women society didn't protect, and he relied on that. When you kill someone who has no fixed address, no family reporting them missing, and no police force with the resources to investigate a nameless body in an alley, you don't need to hide. You just keep moving. He would drift from town to town in his car, boxing at underground gyms, stealing, living in halfway homes. He was never entirely off the grid, but never fully visible either. Law enforcement agencies rarely communicated across state lines, especially in the 1970s and 80s. He exploited those gaps with deadly precision. By 2020, the FBI had confirmed over 60 of his confessions, and they believed every one of the 93 was real. That made Samuel Little the most prolific serial killer in modern American history, and he was proud of it. During one taped interview, Holland asked Little why he never used a weapon. Little chuckled. "Strangulation," he said, "was more personal, more intimate." He saw himself as an artist, not just with his hands, but with his crimes. Each killing was a canvas, each victim a memory etched into his mind, until he could sit down, decades later, and recreate their face like a memory frozen in time. I watched all 700-plus hours of those interviews. I studied every sketch. I spoke to law enforcement in 5 states. I met with families who finally had names to bury, gravestones to mark, and voices to mourn. But none of this happened until a tired old man in a cell decided it was time to tell his story. And I couldn't help but ask myself, what if he had never drawn? What if no one had listened? Chapter 2. The Women We Forgot. The deeper I went into Samuel Little's case, the more I realized his crimes weren't just about a man. They were about a system. A system that decided some lives were worth remembering and others were not. The majority of Little's victims were women of color. Many struggled with addiction. Some were sex workers. Others were simply poor, alone, or dealing with mental health issues. They were people who existed in the margins, outside of headlines, outside of privilege, outside of protection. In the eyes of their communities, they were real. But to the criminal justice system, they were whispers. Afterthoughts. That's exactly what Samuel Little counted on. From the late 1970s through the early 2000s, Little moved freely through more than a dozen states. He had no fixed address. He slept in his car or cheap motels. Sometimes he stayed in halfway houses or with strangers he'd met in bars. He didn't need to hide. He chose women no one would chase. When you look at the victim list, a disturbing pattern emerges. There's Rose Evans, 32, murdered in Cleveland in 1991. Her body was dumped in an empty lot behind an abandoned factory. She had no next of kin to speak of. There's Denise Christie Brothers, found in Odessa, Texas, in 1994. No one connected her death to Little until 2018. That's when Holland took him a photo. Little looked at it for 1 second and said, "That's her. I left her near some tall weeds by a car wash." He was right. Then there's Miriam Chapman, a soft-spoken woman from Tennessee. She was only 25 when she disappeared in the early 80s. Her family reported her missing. No one listened. Her case was never entered into a national database. It took 37 years and a prison drawing before anyone remembered her name. As I studied these stories, I felt something twist in my gut. These women had been discarded twice, once by their killer, and again by the silence that followed. And the only reason some of them were being identified now was because the man who killed them decided to cooperate. That truth still makes me sick. I visited families in Memphis, in Miami, in Los Angeles. Many of them were hesitant to talk at first. They'd spent decades carrying the weight of not knowing. Some had been told by police that their loved ones had probably just run off. Some had been warned not to expect results. For many of these families, there was no justice system, only grief. A woman named Lorraine Hightower invited me into her home in rural Arkansas. Her cousin, Nancy Stevens, vanished in 1982. She was last seen leaving a nightclub with a tall man in a blue car. Lorraine spent years trying to file a missing persons report, but no agency could confirm which jurisdiction the case belonged to. It stayed in limbo. Then, in 2019, Lorraine was scrolling online and saw one of Samuel Little's sketches. The face was unmistakable. "It was her smile," Lorraine whispered. "That's how I knew. He drew that same crooked smile." The FBI confirmed the match 6 months later. I asked Lorraine how it felt. She didn't answer right away. She looked at the sketch and shook her head. "I'm grateful," she finally said, "but I shouldn't have had to wait on her killer to remember her." Those words stayed with me. So did the faces. There's a strange intimacy to Little's portraits. They're not rough or grotesque. They're tender, careful, each one rendered in soft colored pencil, greens, blues, pale pinks, maroons. Some women wear earrings, some have lipstick, some wear hats or scarves. Little claimed he drew them from memory, but the accuracy is chilling. In dozens of cases, family members confirmed it was their relative within seconds. And yet, many of these portraits still remain unmatched. Dozens of faces with no names, no case files, no confirmed deaths. These women are still out there, in unmarked graves or cold case folders gathering dust. Their families might still believe they simply disappeared. Some might not even know they're gone. That's the true horror of Samuel Little's crimes. He didn't just kill, he erased. He preyed on women who had already been forgotten by systems designed to protect them. And in doing so, he forced America to confront a brutal truth. Not all victims are treated equally. Even now, in 2025, the FBI is still asking the public to help identify the remaining women. His confessions were verified in over 60 cases, but more than 30 remain open. Not because Little recanted, but because there are no records to support his claims. No DNA, no missing persons report, just a sketch and a memory. The irony is cruel. A man who murdered them is now their only witness. During a rare interview with Holland in 2019, Little explained why he was finally talking. "They're gone," he said. "Ain't nothing gonna change that, but maybe I can help them be found." Some call it remorse. I call it legacy. He wanted to be remembered. Not as a killer, but as someone who gave names back, and part of me still resents that. He stole their lives, but in the end, we needed him to restore their dignity. That should never have been the case. Justice shouldn't be built on the memories of a killer. It should be built on the belief that every victim matters, whether the world knew their name or not. As I reviewed more files and traveled to more cities, One question burned through every interview, every press briefing, every confirmation email. How many more Samuels are still out there, and how many more women have we forgotten? Chapter 3. Portraits in the Dark. The sketches weren't what I expected. When I finally saw the originals, laid out across a long conference table in Quantico, they didn't scream horror. They whispered. Each face stared out from a sheet of paper with soft expression, distant eyes, and unnerving peace. They were not caricatures. They were intimate, detailed, personal. Samuel Little drew from memory, but what lived in his mind was clearer than most police reports. He shaded hair with care. He blended lip color. He gave these women the kind of attention he likely never gave them in life. And somehow, decades later, he could remember it all. The portraits, dozens of them, were arranged in chronological clusters by the FBI. California women in one section, Texas and Florida in another. Unmatched faces on a separate board marked unknown. Each one a haunting plea for recognition. And people responded. In the days after the FBI released 16 of those sketches to the public, their website flooded with traffic. Tips came in from everywhere. Some led to dead ends, but others cracked cold cases wide open. One of the first confirmed matches was Rosie Hill, murdered in 1982 in Marion County, Florida. Her family had given up hope decades ago, but a neighbor saw the sketch online and made the call. Then came Linda Alford, last seen in Louisiana in 1981. Her sister instantly recognized her portrait. They'd both worked at a diner off Interstate 10. Linda disappeared after a late shift. For years, her family thought she'd run away. But Samuel Little remembered her. She had gold hoop earrings, he said, and wore bright yellow nail polish. That matched the morgue photo perfectly. Little's memory was sharp, eerily so. He didn't just draw faces. He recalled the settings, the smells, the weather. In one case, he remembered a woman from Atlanta who had a stutter and wore a broken heel. In another, he described a Mississippi woman's tattoo, something never released publicly. I asked Ranger James Holland how it was possible. How could a man who lived on the run for decades hold such vivid, precise images of women he'd only known for minutes? Because it was the only part of his life that gave him control, Holland told me. He remembered the way most people remember love. That stayed with me. What disturbed me most wasn't just how many women Little had killed. It was how deeply he remembered them. His brain became a vault of lost lives. He was their only historian. And in a grotesque twist, he used art to resurrect them. The portraits traveled beyond law enforcement. Nonprofits began printing them. Victim advocacy groups circulated them on social media. Some were featured in newspapers. Others appeared in memorial exhibits across the country. One of the most striking came from Los Angeles. At a community center in South Central, organizers hung a wall-sized mural composed of 16 portraits drawn by Little. Below each face was a blank space with a single word in white. Name? Locals stopped to look. Some wept. Some pointed. Within 3 weeks, two of the women were identified, and yet many remain unnamed. I remember sitting in the FBI's Victim Services Division, flipping through a binder of sketches marked unmatched. One woman wore a soft pink tank top. Her eyes tilted upward, hopeful. Another had a scar on her right cheek and a long braid. There was no data, no police report, no missing person filed. Just a portrait and the year Little claimed he killed her. Years when America was building highways and prisons, but not databases for missing women. We talk often about closure in true crime, but the reality is, there is no closure for the unknown. How do you grieve someone you can't name? How do you file a lawsuit, request a death certificate, hold a funeral, when the only evidence of their existence is a sketch drawn by their killer? This chapter of Little's story is not about justice. It's about memory, about the emotional labor of recognition. It's about families whose only link to the truth is a drawing released decades too late. I interviewed one of the forensic artists who reviewed Little's sketches for consistency. She told me something I'll never forget. These drawings weren't about accuracy, she said. They were about ownership. He killed them, but in some twisted way, he wanted them to live through him. She was right. There is a darkness in that kind of memory, a violence not just of the body, but of legacy. Samuel Little built his own archive. He cataloged the women he killed. He kept them alive, if only in pencil and pigment. And America had no choice but to look. In 2020, Little died in a California prison hospital. The cause was heart failure, compounded by diabetes and other chronic illnesses. He was 80 years old. When the news broke, some breathed relief, others felt robbed. There were still dozens of cases left unsolved, still names unknown. His death meant no more confessions, no more sketches, no more answers. But the images remained, hung in small-town precincts and big-city crime labs, scanned into databases, reprinted on flyers, shared in online forums by strangers who swore they saw something familiar in the eyes of a woman who once walked the same streets they did. The FBI continues to update its gallery. As of now, 31 of Little's victims remain unidentified. And somewhere, in a box, in a drawer, or in the memory of a relative who never stopped wondering, the final match may still exist. Chapter 4. The Ranger and the Killer. It started with a phone call. Texas Ranger. James Holland was known within law enforcement circles as a closer, someone you called when cases stalled or suspects stopped talking. He had a calm voice, sharp instincts, and a reputation for making even the hardest criminals confess. But nothing in his 20-plus year career prepared him for Samuel Little. The Los Angeles Police Department had already secured Little's conviction for 3 murders in 2014. But when his name surfaced in cold cases across the country, the FBI needed someone who could get inside his mind. Holland, who had worked with the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, VICAP, was asked to take a shot. So in the spring of 2018, Holland walked into a California state prison with a stack of files and a singular goal. Get Samuel Little to talk. What followed was not a single interview, but a series of dozens of interrogations over the course of more than 700 hours. They didn't happen in a sterile room with a two-way mirror. Instead, they sat across from each other in a plain prison meeting area. No restraints, no shouting, just conversation. And Holland knew the key wasn't pressure, it was patience. He asked about boxing, about traveling, about cars. He learned the rhythm of Little's speech, the quirks in his memory, the things that made him laugh. And slowly, the walls came down. Samuel Little began to confess. Not just to one or two murders, but dozens. At first, Holland didn't believe him. Some of the dates didn't line up. Some victims weren't in any database. But then Little started naming details no one else could know. He described a Miami woman's chipped tooth, a Cleveland woman's red scarf with gold trim. He remembered where the bodies were left, what roads he drove, and what music was playing on the radio. And he wasn't guessing, he was recalling. Holland's job now shifted from interrogation to verification. Every confession had to be matched against police records, autopsy reports, and missing persons files across multiple states. It became a national effort. Dozens of law enforcement agencies reopened files that had been cold for decades. The confessions were horrifying, but they were also gifts. For every match, there was a family waiting. A mother who never stopped hoping. A daughter who still asked questions. A brother who needed to know the truth. And Holland delivered that truth, one name at a time. I had the chance to interview Ranger Holland in late 2020, just months before Samuel Little died. He sat in a small office in Austin, surrounded by binders and maps dotted with pins. I asked him what it felt like to carry the stories of so many dead women and to sit across from the man who took their lives. He didn't answer right away. "You have to understand something," he said finally. "I didn't see a monster. I saw a man who had done monstrous things, and if I wanted to find the truth, I had to keep him talking. That was the method. Not anger, not confrontation, just connection. Little liked Holland. He trusted him. He called him Jimmy and often greeted him with a smile. Their dynamic was strange, almost surreal. One was a seasoned lawman, the other a serial killer. Yet in those rooms, they were equals in conversation. Holland gave him space to speak, and Little gave him names. The relationship was transactional, yes, but it was also deeply human, and that's what made it effective. Over time, Holland began to notice patterns, not just in the killings, but in Little's psychology. He didn't stalk his victims, he didn't break into homes, he targeted women who were alone, vulnerable, often high or desperate for a ride, and then he charmed them. He'd make them feel safe, offer them a place to stay or a meal. Then, once isolated, he'd strangle them, always with his hands. No weapons, no knives, no blood, just control. He dumped the bodies in remote locations, alleys, fields, behind buildings. Many weren't discovered for days. Some were never recovered at all. He knew what he was doing. He wasn't insane, Holland told me. He was intentional. Little also had an uncanny ability to remember cities and streets. He couldn't read or write very well, but his memory was almost photographic when it came to places. He could draw a map from Los Angeles to Macon, Georgia, with pit stops, street names, and turn-by-turn recollections. At one point, Holland pulled out a photo of a young black woman found dead in Louisiana in 1982. There were no fingerprints, no ID, just a body and a mystery. He slid the photo across the table. Little stared at it for a moment and said, "That was in the fall." She liked to sing. That one detail, her love of singing, matched a long-forgotten police report from a neighbor who said she often heard the victim singing on her porch before she vanished. Holland looked at me during our interview and said, "That's when I knew. This wasn't guesswork. This was a human filing cabinet." Thanks to Holland's work, over 60 victims have been identified and their families notified. Dozens of cases have been closed. Some jurisdictions are now considering posthumous charges just to give legal names to what were previously unidentified Jane Does. But Holland also carries the weight of the unknown. 33 confessions remain unmatched, and Samuel Little is no longer alive to offer more details. I asked Holland if he ever felt manipulated, if Little played him in some way. He nodded slowly. I think he liked the attention. I think he liked being the center of the storm, but that doesn't matter now. What matters is that we have names, families have answers. Women who were erased from history are being remembered. And then he said something that hit me like a stone. You don't measure justice in years or convictions, you measure it in closure. As I left his office, I passed a wall with photographs, victim IDs, mug shots, Little's own sketches. It looked like a memorial, a battlefield of faces who had waited too long to be seen. At the center, tacked to a pinboard, was a quote, "The dead cannot cry out for justice. It is the duty of the living to do so for them." Ranger James Holland did just that. Chapter 5. The Bodies He Left Behind. They turned up in drainage ditches, in alleyways behind nightclubs, in the brush beside lonely highways. Some were found behind abandoned buildings, curled beneath overpasses, or sunk in marshland where the water covered everything but a shoe or a strand of hair. The bodies Samuel Little left behind were never meant to be found. And even when they were, they rarely told the full story. Many had no identification, no known relatives, no missing persons report ever filed. Some were listed under Jane Doe numbers that sat in coroner files for decades, gathering dust, fading into obscurity. For most of his victims, the only real trace of their lives was the violence that ended them. But for Little, that was the point. He knew how to pick victims who wouldn't make the news. He didn't care if they had families. He cared if anyone would fight for them. And most of the time, no one did. I visited several sites where bodies had been found, not out of morbid curiosity, but because I needed to see it, to feel the geography, to understand how a man could kill in plain sight for 4 decades without being stopped. In Cincinnati, I stood beside the now defunct Lincoln Heights Motel. It was here, in 1984, that a woman's body was discovered behind a row of dumpsters. At the time, police listed it as an overdose. No autopsy was performed. But years later, Little recalled her vividly. She had a gap in her teeth and wore a blue dress. I met her at the club around the corner. When they exhumed her body in 2019, the coroner determined the cause of death was strangulation, not overdose. In Las Vegas, I followed the trail of Jane Doe number 9, a black woman in her mid-20s found in the desert in 1993. She had been there long enough that only her bones remained. Little described her as quiet and kind. He said she wanted to leave town. He offered her a ride. She never made it out of the state. And in Jackson, Mississippi, a community member took me to a wooded stretch off a forgotten road near the old I-20 bypass. That's where they found her, he said quietly. A teenager. Nobody knew her name. Little remembered her, though. She wore green shorts and a white t-shirt. She told him she had just turned 16. She's still unidentified. What haunted me most wasn't the method of the murders. It was the distance between life and death. These weren't high-speed chases or shootouts. These were slow, deliberate killings carried out in cars or alleys, often in complete silence. And the silence continued long after. Police departments in the 70s, 80s, and even 90s were under-resourced when it came to missing adults, especially women of color or those involved in drugs or sex work. The assumption was often, she'll come back, she moved on, or she wasn't worth the paperwork. Even when bodies were found, many weren't linked to active cases. Without consistent national databases, without forensic technology, and without institutional pressure to pursue every lead, many departments quietly closed the books. And Samuel Little kept moving. He told Holland that his favorite cities to hunt in were Miami, Los Angeles, and New Orleans, places with high transients, big nightlife scenes, and overworked detectives. Too much noise, he said. Nobody notices when one girl goes quiet. In a taped interview, he described how he watched their eyes while he strangled them. It was like a TV turning off, he said, staring straight ahead. Like the lights going out in a room. That sentence broke something in me. Because behind every one of those turned-off eyes was a history. A birthday, a laugh, a nickname. A mother who used to braid her hair. A child she may have left behind. And yet, in those dark corners of America, their deaths weren't investigated as losses. They were written off as lifestyle consequences. Only now, decades later, are we putting their names back on the record. In 2019, the FBI created an interactive gallery of Samuel Little's sketches, linking confirmed victims with real names, photos, and confession details. But many are still listed with empty fields under identity. A forensic anthropologist I spoke with in Tennessee told me that several of the victims' remains are still unidentified because of something both tragic and simple. Nobody ever reported them missing. There's no DNA to compare them to. This isn't just about forensic science. It's about societal worth, about whose life gets remembered and whose body is filed away. Little's victims were mostly black women. Many were poor. Some were addicts. But all were human, and all were loved, at least by someone, somewhere. I met Alma Jenkins in Memphis. Her sister, Patricia, went missing in 1981. Alma searched for years, wrote letters to police, put up posters. But the case went nowhere. The city was overwhelmed with crime, and Patricia's past arrests made her an unreliable victim, as one detective put it. Then, in 2018, Alma saw one of Samuel Little's sketches. She had this birthmark, Alma said, right here, under her left eye, and he got it exactly right. She broke down crying in front of me, not just because she'd found her sister, but because it took a murderer's drawing to do what the system never could. I don't forgive him, Alma said, but I won't let her be forgotten. That's what this chapter is about. Not the killer, but the women who died in silence. The bodies he left behind were more than evidence. They were lives. And now, years later, we are finally listening to the echoes they left behind. Chapter 6. Confessions in color. He never asked for a camera, never requested a pen for writing. What Samuel Little asked for, again and again, were colored pencils, soft ones, and paper, white, unlined, the kind that let the face come through clean. The guards didn't understand it at first. Why would a convicted killer serving life sentences want to draw? But those who knew the case realized this wasn't just art. These were confessions, portraits in color, murder in memory. By the time Little died in 2020, he had completed nearly 50 sketches of women he claimed to have killed. The FBI released 16 in early 2019, hoping to match them to open cases. More followed, carefully released, slowly cataloged, and in some cases, paired with newly discovered evidence. Each drawing was detailed in a way no crime scene photo ever could be. His women had personality. Arched brows, carefully shaded lipstick, textured curls or long flowing hair. Some had gold necklaces, others wore hoop earrings. A few had soft blurred smiles that seemed to drift just off the page. They weren't forensic composites. They were memorials, shaped by the hand of the man who killed them. It was one of the most disturbing contradictions I've ever seen. I spoke with an FBI analyst in charge of the project. She said, these drawings were accurate in ways that shocked us. We cross-checked dozens with old DMV photos, school portraits, even family scrapbooks. He remembered the color of their nails, their freckles, the eyeliner they used. I asked how that was possible. Her answer was clinical but chilling. He studied them, not like a lover, like a hunter. Every feature mattered. Little claimed he could recall each woman's face as clearly as if she were still sitting in front of him. When asked how he remembered their features after decades, he replied, "Because I was the last person to see them alive." There was no remorse in his tone. These weren't just sketches. They were trophies, frozen in color. And by drawing them, Little did something most serial killers never attempt. He created a visual archive of his own guilt. But it was more than that. Drawing gave him power. In prison, Samuel Little had no control. He was shackled by age, illness, and confinement. But through his drawings, he was once again the one directing the story, choosing which face to draw, which eyes to shade, which women to remember. And America was forced to look. The FBI gallery became one of the most viewed pages in the Bureau's digital history. Victims' families began scanning the sketches for familiar cheekbones, for childhood jewelry, for the subtle slope of a jawline. Social media users shared them with captions like, "I think this might be my cousin," or, "She looks like someone I used to know." In some cases, the drawings sparked new leads. In others, they deepened the tragedy. People learned, after decades of wondering, that their sister, their aunt, their mother, hadn't run away. She had been murdered, quietly, forgotten, until now. Little's confessions weren't always reliable. He occasionally gave incorrect dates or got cities mixed up, but the faces never changed. Once he drew a woman, that image stayed with him. And when investigators compared those images to their cold case photos, the resemblance was often undeniable. Some officials questioned his motives. Was this a game? A final manipulation? A way to claim fame before death? Possibly. But for the families of the victims, it didn't matter why he drew. What mattered was that someone finally said, "Here she is." I visited one of those families outside Baton Rouge. The woman's name was Monica Joyner. She'd been missing since 1981. Her sister, Claudia, spent years thinking Monica had simply left the state. She had a troubled past, and the police never treated her case with urgency. Then, in 2019, Claudia saw a sketch on the news. "She had this tiny mole just above her lip. Nobody ever noticed it but me. And when I saw the drawing, it was there." Monica had been buried in a county grave under the name Unidentified Female Number 327. It took 38 years for someone to call her by name again. Claudia didn't forgive Little. She called him a monster with crayons. But she brought the portrait home and placed it beside Monica's high school graduation photo. I don't care who drew it, she said. It's the only picture I have of her as an adult. That sentiment echoed across states and families. These sketches, as unsettling as their origin was, became the closest thing many had to closure. Some families even printed them on memorial programs. Others had them framed. The art itself became part of the legacy. A few museums and educational institutions expressed interest in exhibiting the drawings, not to glorify Little, but to expose the hidden lives of his victims. A traveling exhibit was proposed, tentatively titled Faces of the Forgotten. Whether it ever comes to life is still uncertain, but even without a formal gallery, the images circulate. They appear in documentaries, on podcasts, in books like this one, because they demand attention. And that's the deepest irony of all. Samuel Little, who spent a lifetime targeting women no one would notice, has now ensured that millions have seen their faces. Their eyes stare back at us from posters, from websites, from news broadcasts. And with each new recognition, one more woman is brought out of the shadows. Not because the system found her, because her killer couldn't forget her. Chapter 7. Silence No More. When news broke that Samuel Little had died in December 2020, there was no great public mourning. No headlines calling for mercy, no candlelight vigils. There was only a quiet, collective exhale, one last breath held by the families of the women he took, finally released. But with that breath came something else, a question, a reckoning, a shift. Because the truth was now undeniable. America's most prolific serial killer didn't stalk suburbs or wealthy neighborhoods. He drifted through communities where black and brown women disappeared without headlines, where poverty, addiction, and sex work meant fewer people came looking, where cases went cold not because the killer was clever, but because the system was indifferent. And for nearly four decades, no one stopped him. Samuel Little's death marked the end of a man, but it also marked the beginning of something far more important, a national reckoning with how we measure whose life matters. I sat down with Ranger James Holland one last time in early 2021. He looked older, the lines around his eyes deeper, the weight of nearly 100 stories written across his face. He was still working cold cases tied to Little, still making calls to families, still trying to fill in the blanks. I thought it would feel like closure, he said, but it doesn't, because there are women we never found, faces we still haven't matched, stories no one told. The FBI still lists at least 31 victims drawn by Little whose names remain unknown. Their faces stare out from digital archives, their timelines marked only by year unknown or location unclear. But the silence that once surrounded them has cracked. Because now people are paying attention. Nonprofit groups have formed to identify Jane Doe's using forensic genealogy and familial DNA. Crime analysts are connecting timelines across jurisdictions. Artists are reconstructing aging composites based on Little's sketches. And families, those who never stopped asking, are finding each other, sharing notes, filling in holes the system left open for decades. And those who once whispered, now speak loudly. In Los Angeles, a mural was unveiled in 2023. A towering street portrait made from pieces of 50 of Little's victims' sketches, blended into a single, unified image. It reads in bold, red serif font across the center, "We were here." The message is clear. These women are not statistics. They are not forgotten. They lived, they mattered, they were loved. And now, they are remembered. I think often about the first sketch I ever saw. A woman in a maroon top, her eyes tilted slightly downward, her lips parted just enough to suggest a story unfinished. I never found her name. She remains in the unknown file. But I see her every time I write, every time I speak to a family, every time I push for a file to be reopened. She, and women like her, are the reason this story matters. Because justice isn't just about convictions, it's about memory. It's about making sure the next time a woman disappears, her life isn't measured by what she did or what mistakes she made, but by the fact that she existed at all. Samuel Little didn't win. He didn't disappear into the shadows, forgotten and faceless. He died with the world watching. And now, the women he tried to erase, one by one, are rising back into the light. This story isn't just about a killer. It's about silence broken. It's about lives reclaimed. It's about us. Because when the system forgets, we must remember. And when the voices fade, we must be the echo.